I worked on the pipeline when I was a college student. I have visited Alaska dozens of times. I love the state.
An announcement from Interior Secretary Sally Jewell sets off a new round of criticism from Alaska officials. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 27. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a proposal to get Cook Inlet gas to the interior.
It could be a pipeline, it could be a rail car, it could be a truck. All of those things are in play.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to health care. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil.
President Obama is withdrawing 9.8 million acres of the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas from future oil and gas lease sales. Today's announcement comes in conjunction with the Department of Interior's draft five-year offshore plan. Senator Lisa Murkowski has already described it as a gut punch to Alaska's economy. Secretary of Interior Sally Jewell, though, says the withdrawals are limited to small areas of the Beaufort, a 25-mile buffer along the Chukchi coast, and the area around the Hanna Shoal, northwest of Barrow. Except for the Hanna Shoal, Jewell says the proposed withdrawals are already off limits in the current five-year plan.
They already were deferred from oil and gas leasing, and I don't think that anybody that looks at those maps would say that that is an unreasonable amount.
But Alaska Congressman Don Young says the draft puts massive portions of the Beaufort and Chukchi off limits to leasing. Young says President Obama is treating Alaska like an eco-theme park to satisfy his allies. The offshore plan is drawing daggers from environmentalists, too. Greenpeace, the Center for Biological Diversity, and other groups claim that because the plan still allows some oil and gas leases, the plan will aggravate climate change and creates the risk of an oil spill in a region with no infrastructure to support a cleanup. Hanna Shoal is home to a diverse range of fish species and marine mammals. Some of the withdrawn blocks there may be currently leased. The president's order, though, says the rights of those leaseholders are unchanged. Jewell says the withdrawal has no effect on Shell, the only operator close to exploratory drilling in the Chukchi.
There's nothing that we're announcing today that impacts Shell's plans. They have valid existing leases. We've been working very, very closely with them to support the activities that they want to do up there, but to make sure that they're done in a safe and environmentally responsible way.
In a statement, Shell spokeswoman Megan Baldino says the company is focused on exploring its existing leases in the Chukchi. But the company hasn't announced whether it will restart its Arctic exploration program this summer. Shell has spent more than $6 billion so far and has asked the government to extend its leases. The earliest are set to expire in 2017. On Sunday, the Obama administration angered Alaska officials by announcing it will seek wilderness status for the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge. Senator Murkowski this week called Obama and Secretary Jewell indifferent to the people of Alaska. Jewell says she respects the senator's passion.
On the personal side, I worked on the pipeline when I was a college student. I have visited Alaska dozens of times. I love the state.
Jewell is planning a trip to Kotzebue next month to go on a retreat with the Alaska Federation of Natives. She says she looks forward to demonstrating her belief in balanced resource development and in listening to all sides.
And I'm committed to doing that, and I look forward to coming to the state, and I hope I am welcomed.
Alaska lawmakers have described the new protections for the Arctic as an act of war against the state. Now the governor wants to shoot some volleys of his own. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
The decision to block drilling in a good chunk of the Arctic angered Governor Bill Walker so much that he didn't even rule out secession when asked about it at a press conference.
We'll consider all options. I don't think that's one we'll give a lot of credence to, but I won't say we won't. I don't know that gets us what we want. I'll put it that way. So, interesting thought, though.
Walker, an independent, does plan to send a $2 billion invoice to the White House, charging for the loss of revenue potential to the state.
They owe us, as far as I'm concerned.
Walker acknowledges that the federal government is unlikely to pay the bill, but wants to make a statement about Alaska's resource economy. The governor is also considering more traditional responses, like inviting the president and the secretary of the interior for a tour of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And if that doesn't work, he says a lawsuit is possible. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
State and local leaders are trying to determine if natural gas from Cook Inlet is a viable option for Interior's need for a lower-cost, cleaner energy source. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, at issue are some of the same costs that derailed an earlier focus to bring in North Slope gas.
The state-led Interior Energy Project is aimed at getting natural gas to Fairbanks consumers at a price equivalent to $2 a gallon heating oil. The Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation is helping vet potential suppliers, and the governor's office recently refocused the project on Cook Inlet gas. Fedco President and CEO Jim Dodson says current Cook Inlet production is committed to South Central area customers.
We've got to convince somebody that we're willing to pay a price high enough so that they're able to have an investor come in and invest at least $10 million or more, probably, into Cook Inlet and go down and drill a well that has, we don't know what probability it has of success, but it's not 100%. We heard that.
Dodson heard that from Cook Inlet Energy Commercial Manager Mark Slaughter, who met with Fedco and other local leaders this week to talk about supplying Fairbanks. Slaughter refers to the Interior Energy Project targeted gas price as a starting point.
It's a commercial negotiation, so it just will depend between the parties, you know, what's how everything works out, and it'll depend realistically on financing and what level of government involvement's involved.
The state is backing the Interior Energy Project with an over $340 million financing package, but that's for a range of needed infrastructure, including getting liquefied natural gas north, something Fedco's Dodson lists options for.
It could be a pipeline, it could be a rail car, it could be a truck. All of those things are in play.
Governor Bill Walker is pushing the option of moving Cook Inlet LNG north on the Alaska Railroad. The Interior Energy Project initially focused on trucking in gas from the North Slope, but the ballooning cost of an LNG processing plant there pushed the estimated consumer gas price too high. Upping Cook Inlet production to meet broad demand in Fairbanks would also require expanded processing capacity. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Anchorage School District proposes a budget that adds 24 teaching positions.
We took a lot of time working with staff, talking to the community, principals about what their values were and what they needed to make that happen.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. The deadline is March the 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
In his first Senate speech, U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan today spoke in support of this Keystone Pipeline. He likened it to the tie vote in the Senate over the Trans-Alaska Pipeline in 1973.
Then, like now, opponents howled. They said TAPS would be an environmental disaster. They said bird and caribou populations would be decimated. But none of that happened.
His sweeping address went on to discuss the American dream and what he describes as the Obama administration's threat to it. Sullivan says the dream is still alive in Alaska.
In Alaska, the very air you breathe is bathed in promise. The people still speak the language of bold ideas and rugged adventure.
He made a pitch for more access to federal land, for ending bureaucratic delay and curbing the growth of regulation.
According to the president's own Small Business Administration, federal regulations impose an annual burden on our economy of close to $2 trillion. That's roughly $15,000 per year per American family.
Other congressional members have cited that figure, too. The Washington Post fact checker this month awarded that claim to Pinocchio's, saying it's misleading because it leaves out the savings. The Post cited the example of fuel efficiency standards. They raise the cost of a car, but save gas money over time. Sullivan, in his speech to the Senate, also argued for his amendment to disarm the EPA.
In a classic case of federal government power creep, 200 armed EPA, close to 200 armed EPA agents are roaming our country.
Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois made it Sullivan's first official Senate clash by arguing against disarming the EPA.
Senator Sullivan wants them to enforce the laws, but he doesn't want them to carry a firearm. That, to me, is ridiculous. In fact, it's dangerous.
But Republican colleagues from Mitch McConnell to Ted Cruz publicly congratulated Sullivan after the speech. The Anchorage School District's proposed $770 million budget for next year includes 24 new teaching positions. It's a drastic change from previous year's cuts and this year's initial feared shortfall. KSKA's Ann Hillman has the details.
Superintendent Ed Graff presented the proposed 2015-2016 budget to the school board on Monday. He says the administration is focused on putting money toward improving student engagement and maintaining small class sizes. And the decision to hire more teachers is in response to community input.
So we took a lot of time working with staff, talking to the community principals about what their values were and what they needed to make that happen. And it came out repeatedly that class size and maintaining stability in our schools was a priority.
Graff says overall enrollment is expected to drop by about 200 students, though elementary school enrollment will increase slightly. But he says the district will need to hire more teachers for all levels in order to maintain small class sizes for the lower grades and to prevent secondary school teachers from being relocated to other schools. Graff says the budget does not account for the governor's proposed cuts to education funding, which could reduce the district's revenue by up to $12 million in state and local funds.
We developed our 15-16 year budget based on what's in statute.
That means they're basing the budget on the revenue promised by last year's education funding bill, HB 278. The bill includes both an increase in base student allocation and special one-time funds that are currently being used for programs like literacy coaching and preschool. Graff says the district will know the impact of the governor's proposed cuts as the legislative session moves forward. The district will save money by cutting four administrative positions and spending less on fuel and broadband costs. The district will also redirect $17 million of this year's unexpected fund balance to next year's budget. That will close most of the originally expected budget gap. A $2.8 million gap remains. Andy Holloman with the Anchorage Education Association says the proposal to hire more classroom teachers will help everyone and increase morale.
What they're doing is, I think, hitting some of the really large classes and bringing them down. And so that helps everything go further. And we think a highly qualified teacher in a reasonably sized classroom probably is the best use of money.
But Holloman says he doesn't think the district will necessarily be able to hire those new teachers or retain the current ones.
Things are kind of tough right now. We've had a lot of programs go away. We've had a lot of TAs go away. Middle school elective teachers have lost team planning time. And in a lot of cases, they picked up a lot of students that they see every day. And so the upshot from all that is it's still difficult and kind of grim. But finding out that it's not going to get appreciably worse is always better.
He says he thinks many teachers will leave Anchorage for the lower 48. The proposed budget also includes money for technology and curriculum upgrades. The school board will take public testimony and discuss the budget on Monday, February 2nd. They'll continue the conversation and vote on the final version on Thursday, February 19th. It will then go to the Anchorage Assembly for approval. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Delta Airlines will fly year-round between Juneau and Seattle starting in May. This is a change from just offering flights during the summer and could signal more Delta service coming to the state in the future. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Delta Airlines Vice President Mike Medeiros says the response to its one daily flight between Juneau and Seattle was good last summer. So good, Delta decided a couple weeks ago to extend it all year.
It's quite frankly a place that needs some competition, and so we're ready to step in and be able to provide that.
Delta will fly a Boeing 737 during the summer months, which can seat up to 160 people. In September, it will contract with SkyWest, which flies a Bombardier CRJ-900. Medeiros says the 76-seat plane better meets demand during the rest of the year. He says extending service beyond the summer is not a decision Delta made lately.
When we're making a commitment to a market, it's very difficult to pull out. It's difficult on the community, and it's difficult for us to do that.
Delta will also extend seasonal service between Fairbanks and Seattle to year-round and add summer flights from Seattle to Ketchikan and Sitka. Medeiros says the new Southeast Alaska services will be evaluated at the end of the summer.
We'll see how Alaska residents have responded to us. If they respond like they did in Fairbanks and Juneau to the competition, then I think there's a good chance that, you know, it over time could find its way into a year-round pattern as well. But hard to predict that.
Adding additional service to the state of Alaska is part of Delta's expansion in Seattle to connect passengers to international destinations and other hubs within the U.S. Delta has around 95 daily flights from Seattle, almost triple what it had last year. It hopes to grow to around 150 departures in another 2 years. Alaska Airlines spokesman Tim Thompson says the company isn't nervous about Delta's year-round service in Alaska. He says over the years, other airlines have come in and out of the state.
There's always going to be competition in business, and we have to continue to make our business perform just like it has over the past number of years, you know, with an on-time record, a product that people want to fly on, especially Alaskans.
He says he saw little change in passenger numbers from previous summers when Delta wasn't flying from Juneau to Seattle.
For the most part, we still had a lot of Alaskans flying on Alaska Airlines, being able to go in-state and out-of-state as well.
And Thompson doesn't think Delta's year-round service will change that.
I think we have a pretty solid reputation, and we have a pretty good loyalty base here in the state of Alaska.
Travel analyst Scott McMurrin is one of those loyalists, and as a member of its mileage program, likes to rack up Alaska airline miles.
But there's always part of the market that doesn't care about that, or they care up to a certain point, especially if I'm traveling with my family or if I'm buying a ticket for an employee. Delta is going to be able to capture some of that market by dropping the price.
Right now, fares between the capital city and Seattle after Labor Day are priced higher than they are in the summer. But McMurrin says, fear not.
To have the competitive force year-round, fares will go down.
He anticipates round-trip fares between Juneau and Seattle in the winter to be comparable to those in the summer and drop to as low as $250. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the 2015 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Unalaska Lake and the Illilook River run through the heart of Unalaska. The watershed used to be habitat for thousands of salmon, but after decades of development and little consideration for containing runoff, that fish population seems to be on the decline. This week, after months of public debate, Unalaska's City Council will take a first look at $1 million of mitigation projects. As KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, residents hope it's the first step down a path to recovery.
Cowalongan Tribe President Tom Robinson is standing in the middle of one of the most desirable residential neighborhoods in Unalaska. The valley is lined with duplexes and family homes overlooking a winding creek, but it's not all picturesque.
You can see we're at the base of the overland road, and you could see an attempt to capture some of the sediment problems from the quarry.
Robinson's pointing at a pool of murky runoff, which sits below a gravel road leading up to a privately owned rock quarry. He and other locals think this area is a main source of the silt, which has been clogging up the Unalaska Lake watershed.
The amount of gravel that's put on the road, I don't think anybody really thought that the runoff would be a big problem. Well, folks, it is. And it's killing our lake.
For the past few months, the Anchorage-based consulting firm PND Engineers have been running tests on the lake and the river, and they've asked residents like Robinson what they think would be the best way to clean them up and help restore the salmon runs. Robinson says there's been a lot of public participation in that process.
By the demise of our lake, this is probably the first time that I think you saw that many entities in one room taking on a topic.
PND is working with a $1 million grant left over from the defunct Coastal Zone Management Program. At this week's city council meeting, they'll present their ideas for using that money to improve the watershed. One suggestion, better training for roads crews on how to reduce runoff while they're out plowing snow. They also recommend new culverts, ditches, and sediment traps on the gravel roads that run through the watershed. Ideally, they say the city should start paving those streets. City engineer Robert Lund is a big supporter, but he says it's a major undertaking.
It really, really rains here a lot, so that's one of the things we're you're kind of fighting is just the weather and the topography. It's very steep and all that, so those are expensive issues. That's why paving's kind of, I think, a good one, because it really takes the source.
Lund says that controlling runoff wasn't always a priority for the city, but now he hopes they'll draw new lessons from the research that's been done on the local watershed.
There's better practices that we could be doing, and there's not really an excuse not to take care of our environment to the extent that's practical, or at least conserve it while there's still fish in it.
The salmon, he says, are the best indicator of whether the watershed is healthy, and it's widely believed that the population is a fraction of what it used to be. Right now, the most reliable source of data to back that up is the high school hatchery class. They're the only ones conducting regular checks on the salmon and their habitat.
Can you feel it, though?
On a recent morning, students were out at the river measuring the water level and checking how clear it was.
It's right here.
So...
But that seems pretty low.
Yeah.
Well, normally we do it from right on the other side. It's the deeper area.
Senior Cole McCracken's been speaking up at public meetings about the watershed. He's grown up fishing salmon here, and he says he's seen the river change.
Well, the sediment concentration has increased over the past few years, for sure, or more than that, like over the past like couple of decades.
Eventually, McCracken's class may not be the only ones keeping tabs on the river. The engineers who've been helping the city wade through options for their grant are recommending 2 fish weirs to collect hard data on the size of the runs. That could help shed light on what's causing them to drop off. Stephen Gregory is the teacher in charge of the hatchery class. He's a big advocate of the weirs, but he says he hopes the city and residents will go further in tackling runoff.
There has been a perception that something needs to be done, and now I think people believe that there actually are some ways to make an improvement. So I'm excited about that, but again, it's going to take a sustained effort.
And probably more funding than the $1 million the city has at its disposal right now. That's why Robinson and the Cowalongan tribe have pledged to track down additional grants for cleanup. And after a petition from dozens of residents, the city of Unalaska is looking into a special historic designation for the watershed. That could pave the way for more funding and protection in the future. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Governor Bill Walker says he'll continue pushing for construction of a new ferry terminal in Prince Rupert, British Columbia. His administration canceled project bidding last week due to a dispute over construction materials. Federal funds covering most of the project require U.S. steel to be used. Canadian officials won't let that happen. At a recent press conference, Walker said he expected to find a way around the conflict.
It's an important part of what we do as far as our Alaska Marine Highway system. So we'll continue to have that discussion, and I'm sure we'll come to some sort of understanding so the project can move forward.
Prince Rupert is about 100 miles southeast of Ketchikan. It's the only ferry port on the mainland road system in the 1,000 miles between Skagway and Bellingham, Washington. State Transportation Department officials say the current dock and ramp will last no more than 5 years. The terminal had to close for repairs when it was deemed unsafe in 2008, but that was only a temporary fix. Since then, the state has negotiated a $3.3 million 50-year lease for the terminal, which is part of Prince Rupert's port. Transportation Department spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says that's a long enough commitment to justify reconstruction.
Usually when we build facilities, bridges, roads, they have a finite life, and 50 years is a pretty good estimate for a lifespan of a terminal.
bidding documents listed the cost at $10 million to $20 million. Woodrow says if the project proceeds, it's expected to take one or two construction seasons to build. The Alaska Marine Highway System is closing bars on state ferries, a move that State Department of Transportation officials say will save about $750,000 a year. According to the DOT, the ferry bars lose money every year, and closing them will help limit other potential reductions in service. Spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says the biggest savings will be in salaries, but no current employees will lose their jobs.
Crew members that serve or work in the bars currently, they'll be put at other positions, and then those positions just wouldn't be hired in this for the summer and then through the next winter.
Six state ferries have bar service: the Kennecott, the Matanuska, the Columbia, the Tustamina, the Malaspina, and the Taku. The bar closure dates will vary depending on when they're scheduled for their spring overhaul. Woodrow says bar lounges will be offered as additional general lounge areas. The bars themselves will be closed off, but not removed, in case the state decides to offer that service again in the future. Even though the bars will be closed, passengers 21 and older will be able to purchase beer and wine in the cafeteria areas during scheduled meal service times. Woodrow says how that will work has not yet been determined.
That's something the department's going to be working on as these ships enter into their overhaul status, and they'll be working on the ship and find a safe place, but also a convenient place to be able to store the beer and wine, so that when passengers are purchasing their meals, they can also purchase a beer or a wine to go along with their meal.
Woodrow says the first ship due for an overhaul is the Kennecott in March. The last one is the Taku, which is scheduled for June. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Lisa Fu and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. If you're not covered by health insurance, you may be eligible for financial help with monthly premiums and out-of-pocket expenses. Open enrollment ends on February 15th. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Last year, 88% of Alaskans who enrolled received financial assistance. Compare plans and see if you qualify for financial assistance. Call 211 to get free local help. Visit GetCoveredAlaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.